Armoire makes getting dressed easy. With a clothing rental membership from Armoire, you can build the perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you have to do is take a 5-minute style quiz and select items from your dynamic, personalized closet. And the styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new-to-you styles. So I've been using Armoire and I'm actually wearing one of their shirts right now as I'm recording this, and it's a great idea. You don't have to commit to buying the clothes, but you can really start to explore your own personal style. Like if there's a trend or something that you've been wanting to maybe try but not commit to, this is absolutely perfect. Because if you don't like it, you just put it back in the bag and get something else. Because we've all been there. You open your closet, and even though it's packed, you feel like you have nothing to wear. And with Armoire, that's a thing of the past. They make it effortless for all women to turn heads with stylish everyday looks. You can rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion, and it's all tailored to your personal style. Plus, you don't have to do laundry, and you don't have to go shopping. It truly could not be any easier. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month, which is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/ATTWG. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/ATTWG to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that they'll deliver discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. It is wild how different each one of their gummies feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I just wake up feeling amazing. Oh, and the Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they pair THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not gonna just find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out, my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, like, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick. that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
I'm Edward October, and I'm here at the October Pod Ranch in the Great Smoky Mountains. Almost every night here, there's a ghost story party around the campfire. In my family, we believe that scary stories are best told around a roaring fire with a bottle of wine. That's why bold individualists everywhere choose October Pod for their retro horror thrills. Our stories are so good because they're told with such care, understated, moody, and above all, chilling. Why don't you join us for retro horror of impeccable taste? Choose October Pod. Find us on YouTube or at OctoberPodVHS.com. October Pod. Retro horror for bold individualists.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
In the summer of 1996, parents around Clarkville, Tennessee were terrified. Three young girls had been abducted from the area within a month. While two of their bodies would eventually be found, the third, a three-year-old named Lucy Meadows, was never seen after July 25th, 1996. Was Lucy abducted by a stranger, as her mother claimed, or was she harmed by someone close to her? It's been over 25 years, and police still haven't been able to answer the question, what happened to Lucy Meadows? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Lucy Meadows. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome.
Thank you for joining us once again. So this case is actually another listener suggestion.
Oh.
Yeah, we got a message from somebody who grew up nearby in Tennessee, and she said that this case has just always haunted her.
It sounds terrifying at the onset.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's always so difficult to imagine something bad happening to such a small and helpless child, and it's especially difficult when it's a case like this where there are just no answers. So this is going to be a two-parter because, like, basically a lot has happened in the 26 years since Lucy Meadows went missing. If you're a Patreon member, you will have access to part two very shortly after this goes up. And for everyone else, it'll be in your feed next week. Speaking of Patreon, we would like to take a moment to thank the lovely folks who have joined us over there. So thank you very much, Molly, Audra K, and Carlos E.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you'd like to join us and get these episodes early and ad-free, along with Ethan's show about mental health, you can do so at patreon.com/ATTWGpod. Patreon actually now also gives you a discount if you pledge yearly. So that's like a new option that they just gave us if you don't want to, you know, have a monthly payment going out.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. But enough about us. Let's get to the story of Lucy Meadows. Lucy Rebecca Meadows was born on October 1st, 1992, to Yong and Tom Meadows. She was the couple's second child. Yong had given birth to his son Danny in 1985. But Danny wasn't Yong's first child. Yong was born and raised in Seoul, South Korea. In 1976, she was working at a club near Camp Hovey, about 30 minutes outside of Seoul. It was there she met a man named Larry Brookmeyer. He was an American soldier stationed at Camp Hovey. Larry told the Tennessean in 1996, quote, "Basically, a soldier's just lonely. If they're able to talk to anybody at all in a foreign country, if you can get somebody that can interpret to flirt around, you do," end quote.
That's super romantic.
I know.
This is him talking about his wife.
Yeah, well, at the time, his ex-wife.
Okay.
So back in 1976, when they were both in Korea, you know, he was there, they met. Larry spoke very little Korean, and Yong spoke very little English, but they made it work. They married 8 months later, and Yong came to America the following year to start a new life with her husband.
I can't imagine this going well.
Yeah. I mean, spoiler. Yeah, you would be correct. I mean, obviously, because the story that we're telling is not about Yong and Larry. So in 1978, that new life included her first child, a daughter named Amy. And everything seemed fine in the little family at first. They lived at Fort Campbell in Tennessee, which was great for Yong because there was actually a really robust Korean community there. And so they kind of like helped her transition to this new country where she, you know, barely spoke the language at the time and had a baby. But in 1979, Larry ended up getting stationed in Germany. But Yong didn't go with him. She and Amy stayed behind in Tennessee.
That must have been awkward.
Yeah, I mean, I think really tough, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So Larry was from Illinois originally, and when he was in Germany, Yong would often go up there and leave Amy with his parents to take care of. And like, I get that. I mean, she was a young first-time mother in a new country where she barely spoke the language and her husband was gone, you know? And so like on its face, needing help from her in-laws makes complete sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, makes sense to me too.
But there may have been a little more to it than simply needing help. In 1981, so by this time, Amy is three, while Larry was still in Germany. So you got to understand, like, they were married for a very short period of time before he just left, basically, and had to be in Germany. So they never really lived together for that long. So he was still in Germany. Yong filed for divorce.
Oh.
Yeah. You know, Larry was completely blindsided. He came back to Tennessee to try to save his marriage, but Yong was not interested. Like, she didn't want to talk about it. She had made her decision. She was already out.
Hmm.
So Yong and Larry did end up divorcing, and the judge awarded, you know, split custody. But only 10 days after all of this was finalized, Yong took Amy to Larry, who was still in town, and asked him to take Amy to stay with his parents while she sorted out some money issues. Yong generally worked like waitressing jobs or, you know, minimum wage positions, just stuff like that, because, again, like, she barely spoke English and she didn't have a ton of job skills, you know? Right. Like, all of this up to this point, I get, you know? And Larry agreed, too, because, like, he had to go back to Germany and he understood. And so he was like, yeah, it makes sense for, you know, my parents to take Amy for a little while, like, help out while we kind of figure
sure,
out how
yeah.
we're
well,
going to actually do this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, like, everything seemed, like, not great, obviously, because they're going through a divorce, but, like, as normal as it could have been, right?
Yeah.
But Yong never returned for Amy.
Oh.
Instead, she just moved on, and neither Amy nor Larry heard from her for years.
Wow. So are we thinking there was already somebody else, or she was just had enough of the life that she had kind of stumbled into and just wanted to go and kind of see what else was out there?
From what I've learned, I think probably the latter. I don't think there was already somebody else.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that like, yeah, she just did not like the life she'd stumbled into. Exactly what you said. And just, yeah, wanted to see what else was out there. So she started waitressing at this bar called Mona's Log Cabin Lounge. The owner, Mona, was from Korea herself. And so she and Young became friends. Mona introduced Young to Tommy Meadows, who was working as an economics professor at nearby Austin Peay State University. The two started dating and eventually married. After they were married, Tommy was able to help her bring her family over from Korea.
Ah.
Yeah, so she brought her mother over first, then her stepfather, her stepsister, and her 8-year-old half-sister.
Creating the family in the States that she missed.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And the 8-year-old Kay Cox, that's her married name, Cox, but she ended up living with Tommy and Young because, you know, she was the youngest. She needed to go to school. Mm-hmm. And like basically nobody spoke good English. Nobody was obviously from America, you know, other than Tommy. So like he was able to fill out all the school registration forms and kind of do all of the administrative stuff. So in order to facilitate that, he actually became Kay's legal guardian.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And she ended up living with them until she was 15.
Hmm.
So everything was going great. I mean, Young had her family with her, and she eventually had Danny in 1985 and then Lucy 7 years later. Tommy was a well-respected professor at the university. He eventually was tenured, so he was doing great. And he also owned a real estate investment business with one of his friends. The Meadows family lived on a big cattle farm, and everything was honestly pretty idyllic. But in 1994, things started to change. Now, at first, the changes seemed positive. Young told Tommy that she wanted to have her first daughter, Amy, back in her life.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. So apparently, according to Tommy, she had actually kind of brought this up very early on in their relationship. But Tommy was like, okay, like, let's get settled. Let's like see where this is going. And then, you know, we can talk about that. And then she just never brought it up again until 1994.
So at this point, had she had any contact?
None.
We know. Oh, wow.
Absolutely none since Amy was 3 years old. And by this time, she was 16. So it had been 13 years.
Yeah, I can't imagine that going well.
Well, surprisingly, it actually did. So Tommy and Young ended up sending a letter to Larry through like her divorce attorney, I think, or somebody's divorce attorney.
Okay.
Because they had moved by this point, so I don't think they even like had his current address or anything like that, you know?
Well, plus he was in the military, so like, who the hell
knows? Yeah, who knows where he was, yeah. Right? Yeah, and she had, like I said, zero contact in 13 years. So again, they made contact through the lawyer, sent a letter, and basically said, hey, you know, I'm married, I'm remarried, I want to establish contact. When Larry received the letter from Young, like, he was happy for his daughter. I'm sure he had his own feelings about the matter, but
probably.
Like over the years, Amy had brought up like, you know, wanting to maybe have a relationship with her mom, like as any kid would. Right. Yeah. So he was happy. And like I said, by this time he was living in Illinois and they got the letter. I want to say like the day before Thanksgiving or something. And they were both so on board that the day after Christmas, they went down to Clarksville.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it all happened very quickly.
Yeah.
They were all on board. And their trip went well. Like, I mean, they, you know, described it as like crying and hugging and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so from that moment on, Amy and Young, like, reestablished contact. There were frequent phone calls, and Amy would come down to Clarksville and visit as much as she could.
I mean, that's great.
Yeah, no, it was like, it was great. And she got to know Danny and Lucy, You know, she spent as much time with him as possible. She said that Danny, like the first time that they met, just hugged her like they had known each other their entire lives. And, you know, Lucy was a toddler. And so she would just like follow Amy around. And it just, it seemed really nice. And this all went on for like about 6 months or so. Like everything was great. Like they had phone calls, again, visits. Everything was just really going in the direction you would hope it would. But reuniting with her daughter wasn't the only change that was happening in Yang's life at this time. So Yang was raised a Buddhist, but she began attending a Korean Methodist church nearby. And that makes sense. Like, I think it was just more of a community thing,
sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And Tommy said that she had this like habit of kind of like befriending like older Korean women.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was a woman that she met at church named Tammy Dai. Now, Tammy had four children herself, two adult children and two younger kids who lived with her. They were school age kids. And Tammy's husband was in the Air Force. So the story is that Tammy's husband was leaving the Air Force, so the family needed to find a new place to live. Because like I think they had been living on base,
mm-hmm.
which obviously they couldn't keep on doing if he was leaving. And Yang wanted to help them, so she asked Tommy if the family could come stay with them at the farmhouse for a few weeks, like while they were house hunting. And again, like Tommy got it, right? I mean, he understood that his wife needed community and like she wanted to help these people. And so he's like, I'm sure he wasn't like super
excited
about the idea.
Yeah.
But he agreed because he's like, listen, yeah, 2 weeks, fine. Like I get it, you know? Tammy came, but she didn't come with her whole family. She came with her two younger kids. Obviously, the older kids were adults, so they were right. never a part of this.
Yeah.
But she didn't come with her husband. Basically, she just left him, and the two later divorced.
Okay.
Yeah. So Tammy and her kids came to stay at the Meadows house, but not for 2 weeks. They just kind of stayed.
Okay.
You know, it's like, okay, they're there. They don't really seem to be house hunting. Like, and after Tammy and her kids came, Young's family started to notice that she was like treating them all differently. So by this time, her half-sister Kay, you know, the one who was 8,
mm-hmm.
She like was an adult and she was stationed overseas in the army. She started noticing that her phone calls with her sister were becoming like shorter and just abrupt and kind of fewer and far between.
Okay.
And it wasn't just her. Young's mother noticed the same thing with their calls. Like she just wasn't talking to them as much. She just didn't seem as interested in communicating and keeping in touch. And it was like this with all of the female family members.
Hmm.
Even Amy said that her mother, with whom she had just started reforming a relationship, began to act distant with her. And it got to the point where, like, Amy stopped calling as much because every time she did, she felt like she was bugging her mom. Amy told reporter Catherine Trevison in that article I mentioned earlier in the Tennessean that during one of her last calls with her mother in the beginning of 1996, she, you know, just like asked how Danny and Lucy were doing. And Yang said, quote, she didn't want to talk about it because they've been bad, end quote. Then Yang said goodbye and hung up.
I mean, so what's with the change?
Nobody knew. Like, nobody understood, like, what the hell was happening. It was super weird to everyone. Amy's last call to Yang was around June of 1996. And according to her, Yang answered the phone and said, quote, oh, it's you. I don't want to talk to you. Bye. End quote. And then hung up the phone.
What the hell?
Yeah. Like she literally told her daughter, who she had not spoken to in 13 years, reformed her relationship with 6 months or so prior, like to just stop calling her.
And what is Tommy's reaction or relationship like with her at this point?
With Young?
Yeah.
Not great. So, like, I don't know how much Tommy knew at the time about what was happening with, like, Young's relatives mm-hmm. and Amy and everything. So I don't know, like, where he was on that. But, yeah, they were arguing constantly. When Tammy moved into their farmhouse in the summer of 95 and then never left, like, it caused some arguments.
I can imagine, yeah.
You know? He was like, hey, like, what happened this whole two-week thing? Like, what's going on? When are they leaving? And it was just a constant fight. It was just one of those things that, like, every time, you know, he worked a lot, but, like, every time he was around, they would just start fighting about this. And then one day, Young told him that Tammy and the kids weren't leaving. They were going to live there forever.
Okay.
Yeah. So after Tammy and the kids had been living there for about a month and a half, Tommy and Young had yet another argument. He went outside to cool off and Young told him not to come back.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he didn't. For months after that, Tommy basically like couch surfed at friends' houses and continued to support his family. So his paycheck from the university was just direct deposited into their joint account, and Young had the checkbook.
Hmm.
So she had all the money, and at one point, he was even sleeping at his real estate investment office.
I feel like he probably could have gotten a lawyer at that point and maybe made things a little bit better.
Well, no, he didn't want to, because at this point, like, it does seem like both Tommy and Young were, for whatever reason, treating this as a temporary separation and not as the first step to divorce, as it would seem like it would be, right? But even so, even if they were kind of thinking that this was like a temporary thing, it's still a little weird that 4 months into this, so like 4 months of Tommy sleeping on couches and guest bedrooms and his like the recliner in his office.
Yeah.
She told Tommy that she wanted them to renew their vows at her new church.
No thanks.
Well, that's what he told her. He was like, I'm sorry, what? Like, I am literally sleeping on a flipping recliner. Like, we've got some problems we need to figure out first.
Yeah.
But Young was just like undeterred. She was like, oh yeah, no, we're going to do this. And so in November, she just printed up invitations for the vow renewal and brought them to her husband at the real estate office.
Okay. This almost sounds like a psychotic break.
I honestly don't know. It was something. So she brought this box of printed out invitations to his office, and Tommy was like, you know, obviously like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And they got into an argument. And so because it was his office, like they went outside and the argument continued in the parking lot, and she ended up throwing the box of invitations at him.
Okay.
Then a week later, she filed for divorce.
That was a wild fucking swing right there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Filed for divorce and, like, asked for the farm and sole custody of the children.
Okay. Hey, honey, let's renew our vows. JK, 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 fuck you. I want a divorce and I want everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But poor Tommy, like, really wanted to save his marriage. Like, he didn't want to just give her a divorce, you know? Like, I think a lot of people would have just been like, you know what? Maybe you don't get the farm. Maybe you don't get sole custody. Yeah. But, like, why don't we go ahead?
Yeah, we'll go ahead with the divorce, but yeah. we'll renegotiate the terms.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so he did not want the divorce, but Young was, like, insisting on it. And things began to get ugly. According to court documents, Young would come to his university office and his real estate office and cause scenes. She even went to the university president and tried to get Tommy fired.
For what?
I have no idea. Like, the article didn't go into, like, what she said to him. I mean, it didn't work, like, whatever, but it's not a good look.
No, yeah, sure.
She also contacted his colleagues and told them that she would blackmail them if they didn't get Tommy to sign the divorce papers.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This sounds like she had a psychotic breakdown.
I honestly don't know. She even apparently told a friend that she would shoot Tommy if he didn't, quote, straighten up.
Mm-hmm.
It was crazy. I mean, things were so out of hand that in March of 1996, Tommy was granted a restraining order that prevented Young from going around Tommy's friends or colleagues. The judge also ordered her to turn over several guns that they had had at the farm until the divorce was finalized.
And I would hope that they had somebody looking in on the kids, too.
Well, unfortunately, and I'll get to that a little bit later, it doesn't seem like they did. Now, interestingly, so this was March of 1996 that the restraining order and everything was granted and things were just getting completely bonkers. That same month, Young also gave Tammy power of attorney that allowed Tammy to sign checks, contracts, and other documents on her behalf.
Mm.
So Tommy found out about this and it ended up like being a part of their court case.
As it should.
Right. And so she said in a deposition that she did it so Tammy could take care of her kids if anything happened to her.
Okay.
But like they have a dad. He's right there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, why would Tammy have anything to do with this at all?
Yeah. I mean, she wouldn't. And also the courts would not allow that.
Yeah. Like none of it makes sense. You know, like, it was just, it was crazy. Oh, and I should also mention that Young filed for divorce on grounds of adultery and inappropriate marital conduct, which Tommy denied. Young never provided any proof of any of this. So eventually her suit was dismissed and the Meadows remained married, but separated.
Do you think maybe she meant that she was the one that was being inappropriate?
No, she was saying that he was an adulterer. He was having inappropriate conduct. And he was like, what are you like? No, what?
Right.
Yeah, and obviously this is a huge mess, but Tommy still hoped to reconcile with Young.
Why?
I don't know. I guess he was in love. I mean, honestly, doesn't this make your divorces just like amazing in comparison?
Yeah. Oh boy. By and large, I made it out of both my divorces just fine.
Yeah. And I will, in part two, I'll actually get into more details on the divorce, and you very much did.
I'm very aware of how lucky I was on both of my divorces.
Yeah. So throughout all of this, Tommy continued to pay the mortgage on the farm, along with like utilities and, you know, all of the other bills. So before the judge dismissed the like divorce case or whatever, they did say like, hey, you've got to like let Tommy see his kids. But according to Tommy, Young did not. She wouldn't even let him speak to them on the phone. So this goes on for a few more months. But in late June of 1996, Tommy decided that he had had enough, not of the marriage. He was still trying to save that. But he was convinced that like all of this started with Tammy, you know, and timing wise, it kind of did. Like he told reporters that Tammy had been a devastating like effect on his family, basically.
I mean, yeah, like you said, timing wise, it seems that way.
Yeah. Like I said, in late June of 96, he started the legal process to evict Tammy from his home for failure to pay rent.
Ooh, squatter's rights, though.
I know. Really I don't tough. Know what Tennessee laws are because it does vary state by state. Yeah. Some are very like pro-landlord, some are very pro-tenant. Like, so I don't know what Tennessee is. But Gary Hodges, the lawyer who was representing Young, also represented Tammy in this.
Well, of course.
Yeah, right. In this eviction proceeding. And he said that Tammy, quote, is a house guest at Young Meadows' invitation and has done nothing wrong, end quote. A hearing was scheduled for the eviction in July of 1996, but Tammy just said, like, she couldn't make it for some reason. So it was rescheduled for September. So before any of this, like, really got started legally, everyone's life was completely upended. On July 25th, 1996, Young took Lucy to Rivergate Mall in Goodlettsville, Tennessee. She said she was parking her car at the mall in order to take some crafts that she had made to a nearby flea market to sell. Young said that she unbuckled Lucy from the car seat, which was in the back on the driver's side. She then let Lucy get out of the car. Young walked over to the other side of the car to get her items out of the front passenger side. When she retrieved them, she turned around and Lucy was gone. Young frantically started calling Lucy's name and looking for her around the parking lot. She asked nearby shoppers if they had seen her daughter, and nobody had. Amazingly, since this was 1996, someone in the parking lot had a cell phone, and they were able to call police. Police arrived and immediately began searching inside the mall, the parking lot, and adjoining properties, but they didn't find any sign of Lucy. As I mentioned in the intro, this was a terrifying time for local parents because Lucy was actually the third little girl who had gone missing from the area in the past month. 9-year-old Jackie Beard went missing from a blackberry patch near her home on July 8th, and 7-year-old Morgan Violi went missing from her apartment complex parking lot on July 24th, the day before Lucy's disappearance.
And how old was Lucy?
3. Yeah, so 9, 7, and 3. So, like, people didn't know what to think. Was there a serial kidnapper running around the area? Were they unrelated? Were they family abductions? With Lucy's case in particular, there was literally no physical evidence. So police had really nothing to go on.
So no cameras pointing towards the parking lot, the mall parking lot. I mean, this is 96. I get that the quality of the video probably wouldn't have been great, but there were a lot of, you know, CCTVs, mm-hmm. especially around malls back then.
No, you're right. And there was actually in this case. So there was a surveillance camera that covered the parking lot, but unfortunately, it was the kind that just panned from side to side slowly. Mm-hmm. So it didn't show very much. Lucy is never seen in any of the footage, but part of Young's search for her is.
Okay.
So with all of that, like, the police couldn't really do a whole lot, you know, obviously after like that initial search, other than keep talking to Young and like hope that something shook out, you know? And so that's what they did. And a few weeks go by and her story started to change.
Here we go.
Young had initially told police that she had turned her back on Lucy for just a few seconds as she was getting things out of her car. But in another interview on August 6th, she said that Lucy could have been out of her sight for as long as 10 to 15 minutes.
That's a lot longer than just going around to the other side of the car. So what was she doing for those 10 to 15 minutes?
Yeah, well, she just got distracted, like trying to organize the crafts and trying to figure out, I guess, what she was bringing or whatever. So it is a big difference, obviously.
And this is a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm. But police said publicly that while they couldn't pin down why her story had changed, everything else about it remained the same. And again, like the surveillance camera footage that they did have did kind of show, it backed her up as much as it could, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for his part, Tommy wasn't initially fazed by this change in Young's story. On August 10th, he told Catherine Trevison, quote, "I don't believe there is any intent on her part to deceive anybody. She's a very good person, a good mother," end quote.
Well, I don't know how much stock I put into that. I mean, he was still trying to make the marriage work.
Yeah, so, he absolutely was.
Like, you know, sorry, but whatever blinders he has on towards her, he still has them on at that point.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And, you know, and so for his part, her lawyer was like, listen, like, you know, she was thinking about it more and racking her brain, and that's why it changed. She's like, maybe it was longer than I initially thought. And, you know, another theme that goes throughout all of this is the fact that Young still didn't speak great English. So her lawyer says at several points, like over the years, like, it's not that she's being deceptive. It's not that, you know, she's doing whatever. It's that she just doesn't speak the language very well and she gets confused. So, like, that is important to keep in mind. So in that same newspaper interview, Tommy was also quick to point out that there was no ongoing dispute over the children, though he did later say that Young hadn't been letting him see them. So, you know, police were obviously considering the possibility that either Tommy or Young was involved in their daughter's disappearance because, again...
Or Tammy.
Right, yes. Or Tammy...
I mean, I get that she has no motive behind it, but she's an actor in their lives.
She is, and we're going to talk more about that, obviously, in a little bit. Goodlettsville Deputy Police Chief Richard Pope said, quote, "At this time," which was like around August 10th and after she changed the timeline kind of, he said, quote, "At this time, we don't have anything that would pinpoint or lead us to believe either was involved," meaning the parents. But... by August 14th, that would all start to change. By then, both the TBI, the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, and the FBI had given Young polygraph tests. They had also given Tommy polygraph tests. Tommy passed. It was fine. It was no big deal. He wasn't anywhere near anything, like whatever. But Young apparently failed both. Though police wouldn't say what questions indicated deception.
And we're assuming that either the TBI or the FBI, one of the two of them would have provided an interpreter.
So I don't, questions. I actually don't know. And that's a very good question because, again, her lawyer.
If there is a language barrier, that is going to be a problem when you are being asked very difficult questions.
Right. And that is exactly what her lawyer, Gary Hodges, said. He was like, listen, she's not being deceptive. She just doesn't understand the language very well. And that's why she failed. Gary, like Hodges, the lawyer, he went on the offensive and he was like, listen, you guys are demonizing this woman. She's a grieving mother. Like, something horrible has happened to her. She barely speaks the language and you guys are just like kicking her while she's down. And that was his kind of theme throughout all of this. And I get that. I mean, I think that's a good point to bring up, you know, that especially with the polygraph test, because again, they're not admissible in court because it's not like a scientific thing.
It's not science.
You can't say somebody's guilty because they fail a polygraph test.
Right. And I know we've mentioned it on the podcast before, but it's worth pointing out again here in particular is that polygraphs are not a science. At all.
Yeah, no, like not at all.
If you're nervous, you can spike and it seems as though you're being deceptive on a question. Even though they're supposed to ask yes and no questions, as anybody that has ever answered any question, there are very few questions in life that are completely
black and white. Like that. Yeah,
so
exactly.
So in your mind, you could be thinking, well, the answer to that truthfully is kind of somewhere in between.
Right.
Boom. Deception detected.
Yeah, like, no, and that's funny because we were just talking about this at dinner with your stepmom about how she like biffed her polygraph to get into the FBI because she was like, oh, well, maybe, well, yeah, kind
they,
of.
Well, right, yeah, because they, well, they asked if she had relatives in China, and she didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's not a yes or no. It's an I don't know.
Yeah, but that's not...
But that's not an option.
No.
So...
Yeah.
That is a clear example of how polygraphs... Of why polygraphs are inadmissible in court, and they're not scientific.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting because, like, in going back to Tammy, you know, I've read kind of conflicting reports. I've read that, like, Tammy never really gave an interview to police. But in this particular article where they're talking about the polygraph tests, they said that in addition to, you know, Yang failing, that her story of, like, the entire day didn't exactly match up with Tammy's version of the entire day.
Okay, so what is Tammy's version of the day? Because at this point, I don't know why Tammy would have any input as far as other than when Yang left the house.
Well, no, I think it was very basic. Like, I think it was exactly that. Like, okay. When did Yang leave the house? Why did she leave the house? Like, what was Lucy wearing? You right. know, I think it was just basic stuff like that.
Okay.
But yeah, for whatever reason, the stories didn't quite match up, though police never publicly revealed what didn't match up.
Well, sure, they can't.
Well, exactly. But, you know, they were interested in what she had to say, and they wanted Tammy to take a polygraph as well, but she refused. Hmm. Which, again, honestly, never take a fucking polygraph. Like, just never do it. She also refused to allow authorities to interview her children.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. But again, I mean, I can see that too. Like, as a mother, it's like, don't let your kids talk to the cops. Like, I don't know. Tennessean reporter Catherine Trevison was on the Lucy Meadows beat because, like, most of the articles that I pulled were written by her. And so in another article from August 14th, she spoke to Tommy again, who gave her more insight as to why he had started those eviction proceedings back at the end of June. Apparently, one of their neighbors had contacted him, like, that summer, and said that back in March, they had found Lucy wandering alone on the road in the early morning and crying. She was dressed in, like, pajamas. I don't know exactly what she was dressed in, but it was pajamas or something like that. Because, I mean, I'm assuming because it was early morning, but she was not dressed to be outside. And it was early March, so it was still very cold in the mornings. So the neighbors saw Lucy and were like, oh my God, you know, they knew who she was. And so they put her in their car and drove her back home. They knocked on the door. Nobody answered. They, like, banged on the door. And then eventually Tammy answered. Yang was apparently at work and Tammy was supposed to have been babysitting.
Yeah. I don't like this.
Yeah. No, none of it's good.
Yeah.
Like, once Tommy's finding all this out, he already hated the situation. And now right. his, like, 3-year-old daughter was wandering around the road. Like, no. So anyway, after Tommy finds out that Yang was shown to have been decepted on the polygraphs, like, that was the point where he was like, all right, enough is enough.
That was the tipping point. Yeah, I guess I should divorce this woman.
Yes. So at that point, he scrapped his plan for reconciliation and was planning on serving Yang with divorce papers. But before he had a chance to even do that, she served him with divorce papers.
Oh, gotcha first.
Yeah, right?
Just sign them.
I mean, basically. Now, so they went to court, obviously. They had, like, hearings because, you know, custody, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Tommy told the court that he was concerned for Danny's well-being and wanted temporary custody of both him and Lucy while they got all of this sorted out.
Yeah, I mean, given the circumstances of what was going on and the information that he had at the time,
yeah,
absolutely.
Right. And he said that he did not believe that Yang and, by extension, Tammy were taking adequate care of the children.
I'm still going to go back to when the restraining orders were issued,
mm-hmm.
that a judge should have had CYS look into the kids at that point.
I don't know for sure, but nothing in anything that I read said that social services was ever involved with the children at any point.
They should have been.
But even worse, the judge disagreed with Tommy.
What?
Yeah. And said that taking Danny away from Young, quote, would seem to me to be a very dangerous proposition. The child, for whatever reason, has not had a relationship with his father for a year, end quote.
The reason is Young.
But that's not how the judge saw it.
Wow.
And I don't know if it was in this hearing or a different hearing, but like, again, at some point, you know, Young was painting Tommy as a bad father.
Right.
She was like, he's never home. He never did anything with the kids. Like, he didn't care about them. And, you know, and then he was like, what? I took, you know, Danny to basketball. Like, Lucy, before she disappeared, was like three and was just starting to get fun. And, you know, like, I loved hanging out with them. But, yeah, it was just a lot of mudslinging and bitterness. So Tommy also wanted possession of the farm, but he didn't get that either. So by this point, Tommy had been able to buy like a condo in town. And so what he wanted was for, like, his whole goal was for him to move into the farm with the kids. I mean, Lucy unfortunately is missing by this point, but
right.
He's of course hoping she's going to be found. You know, he wants to move to the farm with Danny and eventually with Lucy. He wants Tammy to just, like, fuck off. And he wanted Young to move into the condo that he had bought.
Mm.
Like, that was his plan. That was, like, his goal at this hearing. But that, he didn't get that either. According to Gary Hodges, Young's lawyer, this is basically just Tommy bullying a grieving mother and saying that she never would have even been at the mall selling crafts if Tommy had given her more money.
Wasn't Tommy giving her all of his money?
Yeah. But she said that he had stopped giving her, like, so he, I don't think anybody ever contested that he kept on paying all the bills, but she had said that at some point, like in April, he had stopped giving her extra cash. And I'm going to talk more about that in a little bit. But that was his thing. They were like, well, like, if Tommy wasn't such, you know, a cheapskate, then she wouldn't have had to be at the mall selling her crafts at this flea market. Lucy. And then Lucy wouldn't have been kidnapped, basically.
That's completely fucked up.
Yeah, all of this is. Now, and it gets even crazier, Young's family, her mother, Duck Paik, and her half-sister, Kay Cox, came down for the hearing, like this first divorce custody hearing or whatever, but they came to support Tommy.
Oh, weird.
So they had apparently originally come to Tennessee, like, after Lucy disappeared, you know, because, like, Lucy disappeared. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They're like, oh my God, like, we're going to come and help you guys out. But they ended up staying in that condo with Tom, not at the farmhouse with Young.
And the reason for that?
Well, because over the past year, like, Young had basically cut them out of her life. But apparently at, like, some point, I guess, I think it was right after this hearing, Young called her mom and her sister to the farmhouse for, like, a family meeting. So they went to the farmhouse and they were all outside. And according to Kay, Young just started laying into Duck, their mom, about all of the mistakes she had made as a mother, and then slapped her.
What the fuck?
Well, that's what Kay said. She was furious. So she punched Young in the face.
I'm sorry. I know this is like,
I know, yeah.
Like, I shouldn't be laughing at that, but, like, oh my God, I wanted to punch this woman in the face.
So, yeah, well, like, it gets even worse. So then Kay, who, you know, again, in the army, she might have left by this point, but regardless, she then was like, okay, we're outside. I want to see Danny. I don't know, like, what is happening here. Like, you're crazy. I want to see my nephew.
Good.
Yeah.
Finally.
So she tried to go inside of the farmhouse, but Tammy,
there we go,
was inside and locked the door. So Kay like lost it. I don't know where she got it from, but she found a baseball bat and broke the glass on the door and like reached inside to like unlock it. And then she and Tammy were struggling over the lock and she ended up like ripping out a chunk of Tammy's hair.
Kay is my hero in this story.
I know. So somebody called the police. Sheriff's deputies ended up coming, but no charges ended up being filed.
At this point, did anybody go into the house?
I don't know.
Like,
I know, to check on Danny? Like, I have no idea.
There are children in a house where there was a domestic call.
Three children. Yeah, because Tammy's two children and Danny. I have no idea. Yeah, I actually read two separate newspaper articles that talked about this incident, and neither of them mentioned anything like that, so I have no idea.
This is one of the things that frustrates me so much on all of these cases, is like there are so many opportunities to have a welfare check on the kids being done.
Right.
And look, I get it that that's not the cop's job, but everybody in this situation is a mandated reporter.
Yeah.
Like,
so it wasn't necessarily his job to do the welfare check, but it was his job to call somebody to do a welfare check.
Call social services and say, hey, we've got something crazy going on here. Can you send me a social worker to come down here? I'll stand by because you're the cop, you're the law enforcement. You can technically explain why you needed to force entry if it happens to get that far. But like, somebody needs to be checking on these kids. And like, this happens so much and it drives me nuts.
Yeah. And I don't know, because like I said, I never read anything that indicated that CPS or anybody ever came and or was involved.
And I'm not saying that CPS would even be a great answer, but it would be somebody whose training and experience is geared towards taking care of the kids and less about, hey, let's arrest somebody.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it would add another person to the mix of finding out the story here, because then you would have a child advocate at the court.
That would have been incredibly helpful in this case in particular, I think, as we'll kind of find out. But it's interesting because it seems as though, and again, I don't have the original police reports. I only have like the newspaper articles, but it, like, there were some major assaults happening. There was property damage. And the sheriff, it sounds like, came and was like, ladies, ladies be fighting. And just like left.
Yeah, don't worry about those kids inside.
Yeah. So it was very strange. So Young later said to reporters that she didn't actually slap her mother, as Kay said, that her mother tried to hit her and she raised her hands to defend herself. And then Tammy told reporters that she just didn't understand why Young's family was so mad at her.
Kay is still my hero in this so far. I'm like 100% behind Kay.
Yeah. So like, you know, given all that, it kind of makes sense why they're on Tom's side at the hearing. With no new leads, in early September, police finally searched the farm where Young, Tammy, and their children lived.
How many months?
This is in early September, and so we're talking like a month and a half, almost.
Nobody thought that maybe that was a good idea?
Well, I mean, they treated it as a stranger abduction from a mall in a different county. From their perspective, there wouldn't have been anything of evidentiary value at the farm because nothing happened there. But by early September, like, they just had nothing. So they just started doing other things.
Okay, I get that reasoning, but it's incredibly narrow-minded to pigeonhole your investigation into one school of thought, that it was stranger danger, or a stranger abduction, especially considering the minute they start investigating this and find out all the background information about the parents and the ugly divorce and this other person named Tammy that lives in the house, like, all of that was probably discovered pretty early on.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm
yeah.
sorry. No. That house should have been searched long before this.
Well, and it was interesting. So what I don't know, though, because remember, Tommy was like all like set on reconciliation for a good chunk of this. So they ended up being able to search the farm because Tom gave them permission. I don't know that maybe he would have done that at the beginning, you know? Like, I don't know. Maybe he would have. I'm completely speculating here. But what I do know is that they went and searched the farm because Tommy gave them permission and they didn't ask or tell Young or Tammy. So, like, Young or Tammy just all of a sudden had, like, cops swarming their farm. And what it started with was a Tennessee Army National Guard helicopter with infrared sensors did a flyover. And they detected several hotspots.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a 100-acre farm. So, like, that didn't necessarily mean anything nefarious had happened. It's 100 acres. It's a farm. Like, police said it could be a groundhog. Like, it could be any number of things.
Sure. What they're looking for with those hotspots, obviously, is checking numbers of hotspots and where they are to go and investigate and find out what those were.
Exactly. And so that's what they did. So, like, they found the hotspots and they're like, okay, then investigators on the ground came
right
and conducted a 9-hour search on the farm and in a pond on the property, and they brought a cadaver dog in. They did find several areas on the farm in which the ground had been disturbed, including one that they said looked like it could have been a shallow grave, but the dog did not alert on any of those spots. However, he did alert on the pond and even went into the water twice.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, they thought so too. So then investigators spent the next 2 hours searching this like little pond, which is about 4 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
So like we're again, small body of water, not sure. super deep.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. You don't need scuba gear.
Exactly. Yeah. So in terms of water searches, a relatively easy one. So they spend 2 hours searching it and found nothing.
Well, that's interesting. Water does disturb scent for dogs.
Right. But
so
dogs can still.
No, I know. That's, yeah. that's why I'm saying it's interesting that the dog was so set on that.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Now, as all of this is happening, several tips are coming in from people who claim to have seen Lucy. One came from Nashville, but that little girl was proven to be somewhere else. Like literally the parents of this little girl, like had to let cops come to their home and like show them her birth certificate and, you know, stuff like that. Like, people were convinced that this was Lucy. And several reports came in that said that they had seen Lucy with an older Asian woman in Clarksville and nearby Hopkinsville's Korean communities. So Hopkinsville is in Kentucky, but it's like on the border. It's very close by. And this led Tommy to put up missing posters in both English and Korean, like in all of the Korean stores, basically, like just looking for more information. On September 21st, police searched the Red River, which was located close to the farm, but still didn't find any sign of Lucy. And, you know, they also asked nearby farmers and hunters to keep an eye out for bones or anything out of the ordinary. By March of 1997, police had located the bodies of both Morgan Violi and Jackie Beard and had made an arrest in Jackie's case. But nothing concrete had been found regarding Lucy either being alive or dead. By this point, investigators said that leads in her case were few and far between, and while they regularly spoke with Tommy, Young had stopped speaking to police and reporters. And so that's actually where we're going to end this week. next week, we're going to go more into the investigation and we're going to talk about all of the twists and turns that this case takes, because it gets even weirder after this, because two witnesses end up coming forward years apart and they help shed light on what could have happened in July of 1996. I'll also be talking about the conversation that I had with Amy, Young's oldest daughter.
But the conversation you had with Amy?
Yeah.
Fucking cliffhangers. God damn it.
So make sure you come back for that. And again, if you are a Patreon member, part two will be up ASAP as soon as I can get it edited and ready to go. But for the rest of you, it will be up on your feed next week. Lucy Meadows has been missing from Goodlettsville, Tennessee since July 25th, 1996. At the time of her disappearance, she was 2'8" and around 30 pounds. She is a biracial Asian Caucasian female with straight brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen wearing a button-down blue denim dress with white socks and white canvas shoes. Lucy was 3 years old when she went missing. She would be 29 today. Anyone with information on Lucy Meadows' disappearance is asked to call the Goodlettsville Police Department at 615-859-3405. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you right here next week for part two, or right after this on Patreon.
See you soon.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.